Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for people who play with needles and thread and canvas and whatever.
And whatever.
And Christine, in full throat, feeling better, we hope.
Yes.
Yes.
For now.
So.
Just run with it, Gary.
Yeah, I'm going with it. And of course, we're recording this right after we recorded the Wednesday show, so. We're seizing this moment.
I'm still going. I'm fine.
Yep. So our guest, as promised this week, Gail Cerna. Hi, Gail.
Hi. How are you?
We're okay. Christine's talking. That's all. That's all we need.
I wasn't going to miss this one for sure.
I'm honored.
All right. So Gail, thanks for joining us. All right. Now this bio you have on your website is frightening. Holy
okay.
smokes, what haven't you done? There's nothing. You can't say I haven't done this because you've done it all. So, jeez. Designer, teacher, judge, author, contributor to the needle arts community, teacher certificate, level 1 and 2 in canvas work from Valentine Museum, needle, NAN, 1982, Seasons in the Sun, inclusion in the permanent collection at the Valentine Museum, now resides in the National Academy of Needle Arts Collection at North Carolina State University, judging, holy smokes, you've done it all here.
That's because I've been around for a long time.
Yeah, but you've been busy doing it. So American Needlepoint Guild Master Teacher, honors programs at NAN. I'm not even going to try and read all this thing. I mean, this is just impressive. You degree in French from St. Louis University and in guidance and counseling from the University of Michigan. Go Blue.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Oh boy, Michigan people.
Yeah. Let's talk about Michigan and yeah, Go Blue and Boo Spartans and all that stuff.
All that stuff.
Yeah. Exhibited in shows, best of show in American Needlepoint Guild in 99, Lifetime Achievement Award for contributions to the needle art community from NAN in 2005, and then the book. We got to start with the book, In Praise of the Needlewoman,
yes.
Because we have discussed your book numerous times. I've looked through Arlene Cohen's copy of the book, and Christine owns it.
Yes.
So, and you know, Christine just gets all worked up when we have artwork involved here. So yes,
I do.
This book, it's an impressive book. It's not just some quick and dirty thing. I mean, this is a serious book on serious paper. It really, when I was having breakfast with Arlene, I was like, Arlene, be quiet while I look through this book. So how does this, I mean, we're getting way ahead of your life story here, but tell about this book. How does this come about?
Well, I needed to do a slide presentation so I'd have something to present at chapter meetings when I went out to teach. And so I was putting one together called Portraits and Embroidery. And they were needlework depictions of people, essentially, or humanoids, maybe like Santa Claus or something. So while I was putting that together, I thought, okay, it'll be kind of nice to introduce it with some paintings that show humans, you know, i.e. portraits. And then I got the idea of, you know, maybe I could show something that had people doing embroidery. So I started looking for them, and beyond my wildest dreams, I thought I'd find maybe 5 or 6, and I found, I don't know, 50 or 60. So I got interested in those, and I started collecting, things like calendars and day books and that kind of thing. And then I got more and more interested, and we have at NAN a program called Honors, and it's kind of comparable to doing your PhD, write a dissertation, and you stitch a piece and present it to them and all this kind of stuff, and you make an oral presentation. So you have 5 years to do the research. So I started doing that, and every time we went somewhere, I did not miss ever going to the art museum in whatever community I was in and whatever place around the world, and looking for all these paintings, and I found quite a few. At the time, the internet was still in its infancy, and so I couldn't just go online like you could now and put in woman sewing. You know, you could hardly do that. I will say the Metropolitan Museum Museum in New York did have it online cataloged to a certain extent, but they were about the only ones that I could find. So the internet was not all that helpful at the time. I mean, if I wanted to do the book now, I could find thousands of paintings. So I collected all these over this period of time, and I really needed to learn more about art history because I was only tangentially connected with it. So I really wound up doing self-study to find out more about art so that I could write about it. And then the hard part, which is looking for a publisher. And it took me probably a year, and I kept writing letters. I had no idea how to make a book proposal, but I sort of did what made sense. And after sending maybe 50 or 60 of these proposal letters, finally somebody said yes. And they called me one morning about 8:30 in the morning and said, "We want to do your book." And that was a big thrill.
Yeah.
As you can imagine. So then I had to work with them. They had relationships with this thing called Art Resource where they could use certain paintings without having to pay an arm and a leg to get permission to publish it. And some of the paintings I had identified, they had access to, and then they had some that I hadn't identified yet. And then we used a few more, and we had to pay, they had to pay, to get permission to use them. There's some I wanted to have in the book, and the permission to use them was so exorbitant that, you know, we let them go.
Right.
And so that was a big challenge over time, and they did some of it, I did some of it, and eventually we had them put together, and I was writing my commentary, and then the book got published. Once it was out of my hands, I sat back while the publishing company did it.
I'm glad that you brought up, so I would have imagined that this book would have been written by somebody who is a needleworker and an art historian. And I think the fact that you said that you were not an art history person at all explains why the descriptions are written the way they are, because they're written in a way that people who are not art history majors and are not used to sort of speaking in that language or with those reference points can really understand it. So you can pick up this book as a non-art person and really enjoy it because you're not it doesn't depend on a bank of knowledge that you don't have.
And that was my intention because I knew, you know, my target audience, most of them were not arts historians. And I wasn't, as I said. Now, I do have a sister-in-law who is a professor of art history, and she was a great reference for me. And anytime I needed to know something, you know, I could get it from her. But, you know, I knew my target audience mostly didn't know much about art. They knew some, they liked it, but, you know, they didn't have degrees in it or anything.
Right.
So, okay, I just enjoyed the book in general, and I'm not an art person at all, and I just got to leaf through it. But I do have to address, because we've talked at some length about that first photo in there of the two women. And
Gary has such a problem with, such a problem.
Well, and Christine suggested it was from the period of time, you know, and she had a legitimate explanation for it. So what makes you start out the book with that image?
Well, the publishers all decided that there wasn't any really good way of grouping these paintings, so they did it chronologically. And that is the earliest painting.
Okay.
And since putting it in the book, I have been back to Paris, and it lives in the Louvre. And I took a tour with a docent there, and they gave me more history on that painting, which is that Gabrielle d'Estrées was a mistress of the king, and she appeared to be pregnant. And, of course, it was very important. The queen had not produced an heir. So here's the mistress, you know, seeming to be pregnant and claiming that she had the heir to the throne of France. But there was always that possibility that, you know, her lady maid or something like that could have been the one that was pregnant, and, you know, they spirited the child away, and Gabrielle just went, voila, I have given birth to the heir to the throne. And so supposedly they are seeing if she is actually lactating, which would indicate that she had given birth, as opposed to somebody who was not really pregnant. And supposedly she did give birth to the heir to the throne, and I believe that was Louis XIV. So anyway, that's what that's all about. But of course, to our present-day sensibilities, it's absolutely shocking.
It's weird, right? But yes. Even aside from just the lactation aspect, that the depiction of women nude in that particular style too is so characteristic of that era, and that's from somebody who knows, you know, almost nothing about art. Just walking through the museum, if you walk through the galleries that are from that period, you see painting after painting that look, you know, very much like that. So that's not uncommon at all.
Because at that time they had gone from primarily religious art to also doing something classical.
Right.
And, you know, hearkening back to ancient Greece and their sculptures of nudes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there you go, Gary. Do you feel better now?
I do. Well, I you know, it's such a, for a book of that caliber, it is, you got to admit, it's an unusual image to start out the book.
When I do my talk on this, it is about halfway through the talk, and I always tell the people in the audience, I put that in to wake you up. If they had drifted off during my lecture.
Yep. Well, that will do it. But it, part of what I enjoyed in that book, and I am not a student of paintings at all. Photography, yes. Paintings, no. But so many of those, the way that the women who are stitching and the posing and the light, and you know, the way they're painted, I really kind of got sucked into just enjoying how well done so many of those images are, or those paintings are. Did you, I mean, you I'm sure you had many more to choose from. Was there a selection process? What made it go into the book and didn't make it go in the book?
Well, as I alluded to, we really were kind of hamstrung by the availability and the permissions to use that, because, I mean, there were museums that, for me to reproduce their image five times in my dissertation, i.e., I made five copies of it, they wanted a couple of $100s. And I go, what if I was a starving graduate student, you know, and every museum wanted that, you know, they couldn't do it. And then other museums were, oh, yeah, fine, you know, send me $2 to pay for the slide and the postage. But that was a big part of it, because there were other paintings that I liked better, although, you know, you come to appreciate the ones that are available, too. So there's certain ones I really, really liked, and then there were others that, you know, they're in because they were available for, you know, a reasonable amount of permission money.
Okay.
What made you favor one painting or another over another? So take one of your favorites. What made that one special to you?
Well, I tend to like more ones that I've seen in person. Mm-hmm. I tend to like certain artists like Bert Morisot. I guess I tend to favor the Impressionists a little bit, which I think is common among us Americans. I'm very fond of Mary Cassatt's Lydia at her tapestry frame, but it resides in a museum not too far from where I live. So, you know, I've seen it in person and, you know, just enjoy the whole thing of seeing it. Others, you know, I use some of them. I like the colors in them, but I can't say, you know, there was really one of my favorites. I'm paging through the book as we're talking, is actually that sculpture of the girl from Magar sitting and spinning. It's a marble sculpture, and it's in the Louvre or d'Orsay, and you know, it's just a beautiful piece.
What page? Because I'm going to join you.
Okay. Paging. It's on page 63.
Okay. Thank
and,
you.
You know, if I could take any one of these things home, that's the one I would grab and run with.
Oh, yes.
Although, you know, it's way too heavy, of course, but, you know, I just think it's lovely, you know, the workmanship in it and, you know, the look on her face and, you know, the whole pose and everything. The,
it's beautiful. You
know, the drapery and all that of, you know, her garments. So that one's, you know, lovely. And
so how long from start to finish before you actually have a book in hand? A couple of years?
Yes. I probably wrote for, I did it pretty fast, I guess, for about 3 months. Mm. And then they send you a mock-up and then, you know, by email. And then you don't see anything. And then all of a sudden I got this promotional brochure that they take to, like, book fairs and things. And but it was very glossy, you know, beautiful. And so I had that for about a month, and then the books came, you know, and it was a big thrill.
Oh, I can imagine that. Yes, yes. Big party with the family, or how do we celebrate something like this?
Actually, my friends in my book club and in my stitching groups and just girlfriends, and somebody gave a party for me that way, and it was, you know, all my lady friends. So,
yeah.
And I did some book signings around. I did some presentations at the library with book signings in the local area usually. But I would go to needlework shops and have a book signing there. And I did it at an A&G seminar, and we sold 100 books that day. So that was pretty good. And so those were kind of, I don't know, celebrations of the book, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's got to be fun to do a book signing and talk to all the people who are interested in what you've accomplished.
Oh, right. And, you know, they come in, oh, this is one of my favorite paintings. You know, I've got a print of it. I've had it for years. And,
yeah.
On like that. So that's kind of exciting.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, that's, yeah, that's a tremendous accomplishment. And it's an impressive book. It really is. But, Christine, you got yours at Amazon? I mean, it's available anywhere, pretty much anywhere, right?
Yeah, I did. And, you know, so the other thing, so you talked about the reason that you chose the order was a chronological order. And I think I actually like that a lot because it is a really sort of perhaps unintentional guide through art history in a sense, because you go all the way through all these different periods of time and different styles. So if you go from the very beginning with these very classical types to towards the end when you're getting into expressionist paintings, it's so very different. Yet you'll see, you know, women in the same poses, you know, sitting at a table, and it's depicted in a completely different way. One, you know, will be almost completely dark with a single light source, and then another one will just be, you know, splashes and dabs of paint all the same. You know, I'm looking at the Raphael child sewing towards the end on page 169 versus the Cassatt young bride earlier in the book, and they're completely different, but still it's the same. You get the same emotion out of them, which is that sort of calm, peaceful feeling of just a person just sitting and stitching. And it's interesting because those two particular paintings, just as an example, are so completely different, yet convey the same emotion. And I think that's very interesting.
They're almost contemporaneous, but not quite. You know.
Right. But so completely different stylistically.
Yes, and art was evolving at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of it. But the other thing is that, you know, I was looking around for some pithy conclusion to draw from all of this research. And what I discovered was that in the 1800s, kind of the Victorian era, and this was true both sides of the Atlantic. Now, I can't speak to the rest of the world, but, you know, talking about England, France, probably Germany, and the United States, women, they were reluctant to educate women very much. And of course there's, you know, examples that, you know, are contrary to that. But, really they wanted women to know how to sew. They wanted them to know how to play a few charming things on the piano or the harpsichord or something. They could write, you know, a pleasant thank you note. They discouraged them from reading. They discouraged too much book learning. They thought it would interfere with their fertility and mm-hmm. make them too uppity, and women were really pretty much confined to the house. And so that's why you see so many paintings of women stitching. It was almost kind of marketing them for marriage.
Right.
You know, these wealthy people would have the pictures of their daughters, you know, with perhaps a book, but and then one almost always sewing, doing some kind of needlework, because that said she would make a good wife. And all you gentlemen callers, you know, look at my beautiful daughter, and she is a well-trained woman of this era. And, of course, it's all changed now, you know, and we don't expect women, unless they love to do needlework, they don't do it. Whereas in that era, you had to do it.
Right. Did you find it ever frustrating that you couldn't see what the person was working on? Because if you go through these, some of them, especially like the lace makers, you know, the Vermeer lace maker, you can kind of see what's going on. But a lot of them, you just see sort of a swath of cloth and you don't know. And so for me, I find myself wondering what it is that they're stitching. Did you find the same thing? Yeah.
Well, and people listening to my presentation will often ask that. And, you know, you really can't tell in most of the paintings. Occasionally you can see some detail, but mm-hmm. mostly not. I'm just paging through right now and, you know, mostly not.
No, I imagine because that wasn't really important to the message of the painting at all. Really, it was about the person.
Exactly.
The only time you really see it is when the tools of the needlework are important. So, you know, when there's bobbin lace being made, then you see the bobbins and you know that something's going on, but you still can't see the piece.
Not too much.
No.
No. And, you know,
to hear you guys talk, you know, something that with reproduction samplers and with this here, that, you know, the old adage, women should be barefoot and pregnant. And when you hear you guys talk about these paintings and to hear the stories that we've heard from reproduction people about why they did these samplers, that whole women as objects was ingrained in the culture much more than I've ever realized. Just hearing
yes.
these things, it really was just part of the fabric. And you can see why it's so hard to get it out of the culture, because, you know, I mean, to market, when you say market my daughter as it would be a good wife
right.
because she can stitch, I'm, you know, signs of the time, but, it really, you really, as you look at these things, get hit right between the eyes with how much of a, how real that was.
It's a huge culture shift. Yeah, because I think it, especially
in periods of time. In many cultures.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Marriage wasn't about a match. It was more of a contractual thing. And as you just said, you know, arranged marriages still occur pretty much exactly the same way in different areas of the world. Not in America here now, but at the times that these paintings were being made, it was absolutely that. It was about making a good match that was going to benefit your family, was going to position your daughter in a place where she'd be well cared for if, you know, if she was lucky. More often than not, it was more about, you know, benefiting the family that she was coming from. So, yes, it was about commodities, right? Women weren't allowed to own property. So a lot of it was about exchange of goods and services in a sense. So it was a contractual thing as opposed to an emotional one.
And that whole struggle still goes on to a certain extent.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, sadly. Yeah. Yes. All right, back to the beginning. Now,
okay.
Now
okay.
All the things you started as a child learning how to stitch.
Right.
And
yes.
I'm always amazed at, I don't care, male or female, whatever, when you start something as a child and then to carry this all the way through your life and actually amplify your involvement in stitching by several factors. What is it about that? What do you remember about those early days of stitching that just got you so hooked on it that you never gave it up?
You know, I don't think I had ever given it any thought. And then my aunt, my father's sister, gave me those little squares they used to sell in the dime store and some thread and the needle. And this was Christmas Day, and she showed me how to do some things. And I just took it and went into a corner and ignored the family for the rest of the day practically. And I had the thing about half done by the time we went home. And, you know, it must have really engaged me. I just loved it. And this was back in the day. You know, I took the bus to the dime store and bought more of these and some more colors and really, really liked doing it. And then we did it in Girl Scouts the following year, or maybe 2 years later, and they decided the first thing we would do is get the Needlecraft badge. And, you know, so we had this sampler that we made, and, you know, I had mine finished right away. It was obviously just something I gravitated to immediately, mm-hmm. and, you know, really never stopped. A little bit in college, I more was knitting, but, you know, right back to it after that. So
even through school and high school, when you had spare time, you were stitching?
Or reading. But I would do things like monogram my blouses.
Oh, okay.
And
all
just
right.
draw the letters on and stitch them. I was not a real purist about it at all. But, you know, I would do that or make something for somebody in the family, you know. And I don't know. It just was so automatic, and I never didn't like it.
I think you hit on something, too. When you learn something at that young of an age, it's something you take for granted in the best way. And
yes.
What I mean by that is that you never think, oh, that's going to be difficult, or that's something that's going to be a big project or something. It's just something that's natural to you. So, of course, it's nothing for you to pick up and say, I like my blouse, but I'd like my initials on it, so I'm going to do that. You know,
right.
you just assume you can, and you go ahead and do it.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, it never occurred to me that I couldn't do it right, you know.
Mm-hmm. So. Right. There's freedom there when you're not afraid to try.
And, you know, did I make mistakes? Yes. But, you know, that's how you learn.
Mm-hmm.
When is it that maybe it's not a leap, maybe it's just a gradual thing, but when is it that you become a designer? I'm always intrigued by what is the mental process that takes you from someone who stitches to saying, wait a minute, I can create my own designs and be effective at it.
I had suddenly discovered needlepoint. It was the 70s. Everybody was doing all these different hand crafts, you know, like macrame and decoupage, mm-hmm. and all those things we did. And one of my friends had taken a needlepoint class. And so then I went and took one, and it didn't occur to me to not just start drawing something on the canvas and doing it myself. And I didn't think of it as designing. And then I joined a guild, the shop owner, invited me to join the guild that they were forming. And, you know, I don't know. I just, it was not a conscious decision. It was just something that kind of happened and evolved, but it happened fast. And then when I went to my first seminar, which was probably 2 years later, I had little kids at the time, so it wasn't easy to get away. But so I went to my first seminar, and after being there for a couple of days and seeing what the other teachers were doing and what was going on, I said to myself, this is what I want to do. At the time, I was teaching adult education part-time, and I started going to teacher certification at what was the Valentine Museum. It's now the National Academy of Needle Art, and that really puts you in contact with other people. You're really networking the whole time you're there, and it puts you in contact with people that know what's going on and know who's teaching and how to get into these things. And it really was a very short time after I finished my certification that I taught at two national seminars. And that was 1983, and I've been doing it ever since. and still doing it.
Can you talk a little bit about what it entailed in order to become certified as a teacher? So the process, how long it took, the types of things you had to do to qualify.
It's a 2 or 3 year program, depending on how fast you work. And they have you design certain pieces, and you have to do drawings and color renderings of the piece that you envision, and you write down the stitches that you think you're going to use, and you write descriptions that would sell the piece to a chapter or a seminar, and eventually you stitch the piece, and you do little stitch samples, and we did that. I think I wound up doing a total of 6 or maybe 8 pieces over the 2 years, and varying levels, beginner piece, intermediate, advanced. You did expertise piece that would where you kind of spreaded your stuff and say, this is the best I can do, and, you know, it's really different and creative. These are all original pieces. And you're doing all this paperwork with it, but it's really been helpful over the years. You know, whenever I'm thinking of a new piece, I draw it and, you know, choose stitches. Do I always use exactly those stitches? No. But, you know, I do it that way. And so we are, when we apply for these seminars, we send in proposals. And I rarely stitch the piece until it's selected. And so all we've got to go on is the picture and the description. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of thing they had us do. We had to make a slide presentation to present. You know, it's really quite comprehensive. But when you finish, you've at least got a small portfolio of things that you can offer to, you know, chapters and seminars.
Now, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say it. It sounds like you're very well prepared at that point because you're skilled at creating lessons, at presenting the lessons, at preparing them in a way that people are going to be able to understand them, at doing, you know, and that's besides all of the needlework that's involved. That's just the teaching part.
Exactly. And you break it down into small, digestible parts and in an orderly fashion and present it to the students. And make it fit in the time frame you have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just about everything you do is for teaching purposes, right?
Not always, pretty much. But I have done Christmas stockings for my entire family, and those are big pieces. And birth samplers for my grandchildren. And occasionally I'll do a piece that, you know, I know is too complex to be taught, but I need things, you know, to present or put on exhibition for, you know, this group I belong to. So most things are, I would say, probably 80% of what I do is for teaching, but there are things that aren't.
So if you had a choice, so what would you do as a piece that would just be for you, for your own personal enjoyment?
Well, I did one about a year ago that is like a garland of flowers, a ring of flowers. There's a mirror in the center section. And, you know, some of the flowers are easy, but a lot of them are pretty challenging to stitch. So that's one I did, you know, just kind of for me recently. And I'm doing one right now. Well, it may become a teaching piece. It's a all-white thing, which is pretty challenging. Woods and a white bear, and it's all whites and grays, and, you know, trying to get the definition of the things and contrast, you know, staying in this very limited
palette
is a challenge. And I'm still working on it.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by those. You see, I think I see more and more of them. People doing single color, like all white on white or whatever it might be. And I wonder if
it's 50 Shades of Gray.
Yeah. But I wonder if it is that for you as a designer, that challenge of how to make the texture speak rather than letting color do it for you.
Yeah. In the most part, I don't work monochromatically, but There's a couple of things from over my career that are, and it's just sometimes kind of a comfortable thing, you know, and kind of fun to use a variety of threads and textures, as you say, and just enjoy that and not have to worry about color balance and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Do you take advantage of all the threads that are available today? I mean, you've been, over the years, you've seen the explosion of threads that have come into the hobby. Do you try to take advantage of that, or do you find yourself still staying in a relative comfort zone in terms of the different types of threads that you use?
Well, I tend to work more with silks and with finer threads. So, you know, at this point, I have not used wool in, oh, I don't know, 30 years probably. You know, maybe once or twice, but generally not so much. But I keep them and see what's new and try them out. And, you know, I tend to gravitate back to stranded silk things like soie or needlepoint silk or esplendor, those kinds of things. And I like metallics, too.
Oh, okay. All right.
Now, I don't know if it's a case of comfort level as much as liking the look.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, your designs, you get to do them. I wanted to talk about some of your designs because there's a couple of them that on your website that just really just caught my eye. The one is the alphabet series that you have as kind of your header piece, where you have each letter stitched in a different way.
Yes, I was taking calligraphy, and I did that because at NAN, we have a new certification program called Teacher Cum Laude, and we said, okay, let's get out of our comfort zone and study some other kind of art, some other art form, and then see if you can integrate it into needlework. And so I took calligraphy, and I really took lessons for 5 years and enjoyed it very much. And then you had to produce a piece, you know, that showed what you had learned. And so here I am. Okay, there's a lot of hands. Hands in calligraphy are what we think of as like fonts, but they call them hands. And there's sort of historically these 9 hands that at least around here the calligraphy teachers seem to teach. And I took classes in every one of them. And so I was looking around for an idea, you know, and okay, I did this word embroider. And each letter in it is done in a different style of needlework, a different needlework technique. So there is ribbon embroidery, there is plain old needlepoint, there is surface embroidery, there is black work, there is white work, there's pulled thread, and the challenge was that certain hands of calligraphy only lend themselves to certain types of needlework. You know, some of them are very angular, and those were the ones that I used, like the counted thread techniques like black work for. Others are much more scrolly and flowing, I can't even think of the name of the calligraphy hand now. It's like Spencerian script. And that lent itself very nicely to white work. And so that was the challenge with that. Those squares that you see are a little over, they're about 3.5 inches square. And it turned out to be a 4-day class. And it's actually been quite successful. So, you know, the students have done well. They actually can finish quite several of the letters quite quickly. And others take longer. But it has, you know, it was fun to do. It was quite a challenge, and it's hanging over the door in my studio.
Okay, so those 9 panels are each of the different hands of calligraphy.
Yes.
Because it's really a neat collection of, you know, we were talking this past Wednesday about Christine doing a Debbie Rowley piece and jumping right in out of the gate and all the things she learned, the different stitches. And this is a classic example of that. If you complete all 9 of these, you really have a body of experience in terms of stitching.
Yes, you really do know a little bit about a lot of things.
Yeah.
But most of the students I get are, you know, guild members, and they have picked these things up over the years. So they know how to do pulled thread, or they know how to do ribbon embroidery. They've done a little bit of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe not the stitch I put in it, but they have some knowledge of it before they take the class.
Yeah. What is it about teaching? What is it about teaching that you enjoy? Is it, I mean, you do a lot of it, so you must enjoy it.
Yes, and I've been doing it for a long time. I at one point, and I taught middle school, and I won't say that I loved it. I liked the kids, but I didn't like the discipline. So then, somewhat later, I taught adult education. There you don't have discipline issues usually. but
in I don't want to know about those discipline issues.
Yeah, you don't want to know about them. but in needlework, you know, everybody's motivated. They're all excited to come to the class. And I've met so many nice people over the years. I've been all over the United States teaching. I've, you know, I just enjoy the, you know, you get just pumped up teaching the class and, you know, to see them actually succeed and know that you've been able to impart the knowledge and that they're experiencing success. That's, you know, very gratifying.
What is the most common hurdles you run into, you know, things that are holding people back or frustrating them when in these classes?
Sometimes they're having trouble seeing. You know, our demographic is getting older, unfortunately. And, well, I guess it's fortunate because they're all living, you know. But anyway, you know, as we get older, it's harder to see the fine stuff, and yet that's what I like to design on. And so that's a hurdle. People have trouble threading needles. And it's partly, I think, you know, arthritis and neuropathy and that kind of stuff in their hands. And those are such basic things. And, you know, it really does deter some people. You need good lighting. And sometimes, I mean, this last seminar I was at, the lighting was really terrible. And it didn't affect me, but it affected the students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I felt really bad for them. And we're constantly worrying about, you know, where can you move that, you know, you'll get some good light. I run into, if they have to make decisions, some of them balk at that. You know, they want you to tell them everything to do. And so I would say giving them the confidence to, you know, get an idea on their own and do something with it. And
right,
not
right.
be afraid of it and that kind of thing. So
okay.
There are some teachers that do more of that than I do.
You have been involved for many, many years in a lot of organizations. When you talk about, you know, the hobby is getting older, what are the organizations that you've been involved in doing to bring young people in, or what do you think they should be doing to bring young people in? Because it's kind of really is quite an important factor in this whole hobby.
And I think people are well aware of that, and we have definitely try outreach, you know, to interest younger people in it. And we're delighted when somebody, you know, 45 is, you know, comes to a class, you know.
That's a kid.
Okay, there's somebody young. It is a kid. And we're just delighted with that. You know, a lot of people, you know, they all preach at the guilds, you know, go to your grandchild's Girl Scout troop and, you know, teach them something there, or, you know, whatever group you can find. Demonstrate at things like county fairs, you know, just if you can get them to let you sit there and stitch. They even
right.
were stitching at baseball games. There was, you know, a certain designated day of the year when we were all supposed to go to the baseball game in our local community. I'm talking about the professional, you know, stitch and pitch or something, but and, you know, sit there and stitch during the baseball game. And I don't know how many people actually did that, but it was sort of intriguing. And so we, you know, we do try to do outreach somewhat. It's not so easy. I think, you know, I keep saying the young people today, you know, they're often working women with children. When do they have time to do this?
Right.
And yeah. if they have any spare time, they go to the gym. And so to tell them, oh, you know, you might enjoy stitching and maybe when I'm older sort of thing. And I mean, that's true even of my own daughter. She's very good, but there's no time.
Right. And what I find, so from my perspective, you know, being a working mother, it's difficult to, I tried joining a local chapter and it was impossible because the only time that they had meetings was either during working hours or immediately following working hours where I have to go home and be a mother. So yeah, the only time that I stitch is at 10 o'clock at night. And there aren't guild meetings at 10 o'clock at night. So that's, you know, that's your time. So it's sort of organizing people, getting the time that they have available all to sort of coincide is almost impossible. That's the tough part when you're working, I think. And if you're working and a parent at the same time, then pretty much your daylight hours are somebody else's.
Exactly. And so it's hard. I mean, even people that don't have little children, they still have to go home and be with the family after work. And, you know, so our guild meetings have been in the evening. Now we're to the point where people are getting older and they're saying, yeah, I'm having trouble seeing to drive to the guild meetings, especially in the winter. And, you know, we live far north, so it gets dark early. And so it's a problem, you know, and I don't know what the solution is.
Yeah. The other part that strikes me that plays into it, you mentioned about getting your needlework badge in Girl Scouts. And Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts used to be such a dominant part of growing up. And anymore, that's just kind of fallen away. And, of course, the fact that we don't have home ec and wood shop and those kinds of classes in school anymore all take away from that exposure to things other than math and English.
And that's so true.
Well, they do. So in New York, I can say, you know, I'm looking at a needlework project that my son did last year that was a stitch a stuffed animal project. So it's not needlepoint or anything like that. But no, they still do those things. It's much more limited than it was when we were kids, for sure.
Exactly.
Because it used to be a whole year and you would do cooking and sewing and that was it. And now it's, you know, it's a module, you know, and basically that's all you do is basically a big giant running stitch or a back stitch. So he did a great back stitch though, I'll tell you.
Oh, all right. Very good. Well, my grandchildren have done a little bit of it. They, because my daughter works full time, they're in an after school program and she signed them up for the art class and the art teacher. One of the things she's had them do is do some embroidery, and boys and girls both, and you know, they both loved it. So maybe there's hope.
You know, and that's actually a good point, and that I never thought about, because art is pretty much compulsory through middle school, or through at least the beginning of middle school, and yet needlework is never a part of it. That's fascinating.
Well, it depends on the teacher. You know, if the teacher knows how to do it or likes to do it, then they might get it.
Mm-hmm.
But just the average run of the mill. Okay, well, at the elementary school that my children attended, they introduced a program called Art Lady. And on Friday afternoons, I believe from 1 to 2, they had various mothers or certain ones that wanted to would go in and visit various classrooms and talk about art. And my sister chose to talk about needlework. Now, she's only cursorily stitches, but she, you know, knows about it because of me, and she took some of my pieces and told the kids all about needlework. So at least they were exposed to needlework as an art form back then. Now, that was over 20 years ago, so, you know, who knows, but that is something they can do.
It's one of those things, and maybe I'm just weird, but in middle school, you know, we had one of your things for a year, a third of the year, was shop, art, and then home ec for everyone. And
right,
you know, I remember very, very few of my teachers through the years. Very few. I'm not one of those people who can click off who I had each year for each class. I can't do that. But in that series, Miss Sakamoto was, I will always remember that because we made a quilt and we learned to cook and iron, and, you know, she took us through all the basic home ec things. And it, of course, it became, in the class, it was a competition. It was boys against the girls who could, you know, who could crank out the recipe of the day and make it perfect. And of course, it was a lot of fun, and it was a break from the math and the science and all those things. But, you know, I look back at those days and what we learned, just the basic things we learned there that carry you all, you know, they're with you all the way through life. You know, how to boil water, simple things like that. you know, how to sew on a button, you know, those kinds of things. And people just don't do those things anymore. And it's, and, you know, and I, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, all those things that, that taught you those basic skills, life skills that, if your parents don't teach them anymore, a lot of times, you know, kids just don't get them.
Exactly. I can't believe our Girl Scout leaders taught us all how to sew on a sewing machine.
Oh.
And, you know, imagine 20, you know, 10-year-olds, and we all learned to sew on a sewing machine.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone even of my age that knows how to sew on a sewing machine besides me, honestly. Now that I'm actually sort of rifling through my Rolodex in my head, and I really don't actually know a single other person that can make clothing.
Well, my daughter does.
Okay, good. There's somebody.
Yes, there's somebody, and her children are about the ages of yours, so you might be contemporaries.
Good. Well, they're selling sewing machines for something, so somebody's doing something with them besides making costumes for Renaissance fairs. I'm convinced of this.
I think there's a lot of avid quilters still around.
Yes, true.
Yeah.
We're going to run out of time here, Gail, and people always want to know, our guests, what is your stitching area like? What do you have as a place to do your designing and your stitching?
Well, I really lucked out on this. My husband collects and restores, et cetera, antique cars. And so he was putting an extension on our basement, which is a walk-up basement. And now it's a drive-in basement. And so when he put this addition on, he said, I guess we'll just have to have a flat roof. And I said, no, I think I can have a studio above that addition. So I have this wonderful room that's got windows on three sides, and it's got skylights on, you know, in the roof, and a big long table down the middle where I sometimes have classes, and I've got lots of bookshelves, and so it's a wonderful room to just kind of hang out in, and I've managed to keep it my own over the years and keep his car paintings out of it. But anyway,
and it's always good. Yep, you have to have a spouse with another hobby.
Exactly. And there's the hallway that comes down to my studio that's part of the addition, but you know, it's just solid walls, and except for a couple of doorways. And that's hung with all my pieces that I've done probably in the last 20 years. Floor to ceiling, I mean, some of these things are hanging down by your ankles, and some of them are so high you can't really see. But anyway, that's where all my pieces are, and that's kind of fun even for me to look at. And I see them all the time, and other people always want to see them. And they're, you know, pretty much all in the one place. So that's what it's like.
You just made a bunch of people jealous. I'm telling you that right now.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I've had people say they've got studio envy when they're here.
Yeah. is that something? I mean, you, a big space with surface area and all the designing you do, and you obviously, I'm confident, have a pretty large collection of threads and canvas supplies and so on. Hard to keep that organized. I mean, are you constantly fighting keeping things from just piling up everywhere? Is that?
Yeah, it gets pretty messy once in a while. You know,
okay.
If I'm making kits and designing a new piece, and then I have to, you know, okay, I can't stand it anymore because I'm a pretty tidy person. And, you know, then I have to just clean it up and restore order.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that the reason I ask that is I got to believe once you get into a design. You're working on a design. Everything else just kind of falls to the wayside as you work your way through it.
Yes, threads spread out all over the place. But when I'm stitching something, I try to keep it, the threads that I have for the piece on a tray. And so I can pick the tray up and go somewhere else, like go into the family room and stitch there, or the kitchen table or whatever, you know, if I'm so inclined, because I have a stitch group that comes here almost every week. Uh-oh. And so I have to get that table cleared off before they get here. And so it can't just remain a heap for too long.
Okay.
That's
the ladies
good,
are coming.
Actually.
Yeah, the ladies are coming. Yeah. Got to clean up. Do you do you stitch a lot? I always wonder, do you stitch as much as you design in the evening?
Yes.
Is that what you're doing? It's still fun for you?
Yes. My only problem is I tore my rotator cuff about 9 months ago, and then I had to have surgery, and it's really slowed me down on that. So, but I did do two pieces this summer under some duress, and now I'm, you know, back to the one I talked about, the all white one. But yes, in general, and I used to stitch whenever I could, and I would stitch in the afternoon and all evening and all that. And as I've gotten older, I find it harder to stitch at night because I get tired. But and I find all my colleagues saying the same thing. So we're starting to stitch in the morning when we're, you know, more alert.
Yeah.
So I keep hoping I can get back into this full throttle, you know, when my arm feels better. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that always hurts. Yeah, when you, something like that, something physical prevents you from.
Yes.
Your mind wants to go and go and go, and you can't do it. Yeah.
Yes, because I got ideas, but, you know, I can't do anything much about them, you know. And
right.
Because I can't go fast anymore right now.
Yep. So coming up now, teaching classes between now and the end of the year, where are you going to be at?
Well, we are going to South Africa for the whole month of October, so
oh
no,
oh.
I'm not teaching then. But my next class that's scheduled, I think, is next March.
Oh.
So right now I don't have, you know, I intentionally, because I knew I had the surgery, and so I intentionally didn't, and there's no seminars from now through the end of the year, so it would have to be chapters. And
yeah.
Right now I have no commitments, so.
Mm. Yeah, that, all those seminars just kind of all came at once there.
Oh, they always do.
Oh.
You know, and even all the regionals, you know, pile up in the sort of end of April till, I don't know, July. And, you know, and then you can be really busy and then, you know, then do nothing. But you need some downtime to, you know, think.
Yep. Well, you actually have to plan and stitch some, too, you know.
There is that, yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, Gail, this has been a treat. Thanks for doing this with us.
It has been a treat for me especially, and thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
Thank you.
Real
I'm
pleasure.
I'm very pleased and thrilled. Yes.
Got to have you back, too. I got more questions, so we'll have you back.
Okay.
All right. That's gonna be it for this week, and Christine and I will be back on Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Take care.